The disputes over the U.S. presidential election result continues, with the projected winner Joe Biden preparing to take office, while incumbent Donald Trump shows no signs of conceding defeat. The United States registers a new daily record of more than 140,000 new coronavirus cases amid a worsening situation in the northeast of the country. Also coming up, the third typhoon to hit the storm-battered Philippines in as many weeks brings the worst flooding in the capital, Manila, in years. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the reigning capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story: the projected winner of the U.S. presidential election, Joe Biden, is working to lay the groundwork for his administration despite division and rhetoric over the November 3rd vote outcome. Biden has spent much of the week huddling with advisors on staffing decisions. This comes as tensions have been running high since the media projection gave Biden a clean sweep in the presidential election. Incumbent Donald Trump has not conceded defeat and claims he is being cheated out of victory. The Trump administration has called for a recount of votes in several swing states, alleging widespread voter fraud there. States have until December 8th to certify their results. And political commentator Jason Inoue believes the bitter and contested U.S. presidential election is a reflection of a breakdown in the American political system.
I think that there has been a breakdown of the U.S. democracy that has been going on for some time now. I think that there has been a great deal of upheaval when it comes to the U.S. voting system. There's gerrymandering. There are questions of the legitimacy of the electronic machines that are used for voting. There's Trump outright himself tampering with the U.S. Postal Service in order to delay mail-in ballots that would not have been for him. So I think that there is very much the U.S. democracy is a broken system. I think that we're seeing the breakdown of U.S. Social society in general, much with the Black Lives Matter protests, the ongoing white supremacist militias that are showing up and have now been killing people. I think there's a definite breakdown in the system happening, and this election is only a reflection of that.
The Secretary General of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has warned Israel and the U.S. against any aggression towards the Lebanese nation and its people. In a televised speech, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said no peace talks would occur with Israel and stressed that the continued American pressure to bring down the resistance was doomed to fail. Rana Alaaddin reports from Beirut.
Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that indirect talks between Lebanon and Israel will continue over the maritime border demarcation, stressing that this does not mean it will lead to normalization. In a televised address to mark Lebanon's Martyr Day, Sayyid Nasrallah said the talks were instead meant to be technical and set limits so Lebanon can benefit from its natural resources.
Many have written that the maritime border negotiations would pave the way for normalization between Lebanon and Israel. This is empty talk. We will never be a part of any peace talks with Israel. We consider its existence to be cancerous and devilish, and this will never change.
Sayyid Nasrallah also commented on recent Israeli drills along the Lebanese borders, calling it a demonstration of strength the resistance has established. He said such exercises proved the Israeli army was in a difficult state, where it has shifted its activities from attacking to defending. Sayyid Nasrallah made it clear in his speech that Hezbollah has strong, lifelong powers that will help it overcome any Israeli maneuver against Lebanon and guarantee victory in the region. He also made similar remarks towards the U.S. administration. Commenting on the U.S. presidential elections, Sayyid Nasrallah said he was happy at President Donald Trump's, quote, humiliating downfall. However, he said America's foreign policy will stay in favor of Israel, despite a new administration. In regards to the recent U.S. sanctions against Lebanese officials, including Gibran Basil, Syed Nasrallah said the U.S. is seeking to cause political chaos in the country and remove the resistance force from the region. He stressed the plan was doomed to fail.
What gives a government like the American one, which commits all sorts of terrorism and corruption, the right to label our politicians as corrupt and sanction them? We need to act upon our sovereignty and stand up against those American policies.
Syed Nasrallah said the U.S. has failed its many attempts to pressure the resistance and turn the Lebanese people against Hezbollah through the war in Syria and the economic crisis in Lebanon. For his part, Syed Nasrallah praised Lebanese officials, including Minister Basil, for their courageous stance against the U.S. pressure, saying it was for the sake of the nation. Rana Alaeddin, Beirut.
Journalist and political commentator Richard Silverstein says the idea of a U.S.-brokered normalization deal between Lebanon and Israel would be delusional, considering the existence of outstanding political issues between the two.
The U.S. policy in the Middle East in general has been an abject failure. It's been a failure in Lebanon, in Syria, and it's failed also in regard to Iran as well. And we have now a very dangerous period that we're in, coming up to the end of the Trump term, when either the United States could engage in some sort of escalation in the region, including possibly an attack on Iran, or Trump could just say to Israel, you can do what you want and we won't object to it, and Israel could engage in such activity. Well, I think it's really quite objectionable for the United States to claim that as Israel normalizes with the Gulf states, with Saudi Arabia, and it hasn't yet done that with Saudi Arabia, but that's coming, that the same thing will happen with Lebanon. There is an issue of the seabed and the oil and gas that has to be eventually negotiated between Israel and Lebanon, but that has nothing to do with the outstanding political issues between the two countries and the issue of territory, of Sheba farms and places like that. Those are intractable, and there isn't going to be any resolution of those issues unless Israel is willing to engage in compromise, and there's no signal at all that that will happen.
Turning to other news now, the United States has registered more than 140,000 new coronavirus infections, its biggest daily tally since the outbreak of the virus there. The data by the Johns Hopkins University showed the country also suffered over 1,000 daily fatalities for the ninth consecutive day, with more than 1,200 new deaths in 24 hours. COVID-19 hospitalizations also reached an all-time high on Wednesday, with more than 65,000 cases. The country averages over 1,600 new COVID-19 hospitalizations per day. This as health officials have warned of hospitals facing severe constraints in the coming weeks, with a worsening outbreak in the Northeast and an already reeling Midwest. The U.S. remains the world's hardest hit country by the pandemic. It has so far recorded over 10.3 million cases and more than 240,000 deaths. More people in Europe, meanwhile, have fallen victim to the novel coronavirus as the pandemic keeps rampaging across the continent. Ukraine reported an all-time high of infections with nearly 11,000 daily cases. The latest figure took the country's total caseload to over 500,000. Russia also reported its highest single-day death toll from the virus with 439 new fatalities. The country's death toll stands at over 32,000, while almost 1.86 million people have contracted the disease. Germany's infections also rose by nearly 22,000 to more than 727,000. Many other European countries are also grappling with the pandemic. A surge in cases has led to a new wave of lockdowns, but restrictive measures have so far failed to halt the spread of the virus. France is Europe's hardest hit country in terms of infections, with nearly 1.9 million cases. Elsewhere, a powerful typhoon has battered the Philippines, causing major flooding and leaving a trail of destruction. Vamco, packing winds of up to 155 kilometers per hour, has hit the country's largest island of Luzon and the capital, Manila. Authorities have warned of landslides and potentially deadly storms surging along the coast. Heavy rainfall has shut down Manila and surrounding areas. At least two people have died and three others are missing. Schools are being used as emergency shelters. Vamco is the third storm to hit the country in recent weeks. The Philippines is hit by an average of 20 storms and typhoons every year. An international conference on the return of Syrian refugees has entered its second day in the Syrian capital, Damascus. The conference, jointly organized by Syria and Russia, is aimed at finding means and ways to facilitate the safe return of the Syrian refugees to their homeland. Over two dozen delegations from around the world are participating in the event. The United Nations is also present there as an observer. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad addressed the conference online on Wednesday. During his address, Assad slammed the U.S. for imposing economic sanctions on his country. He said the American measures have hampered efforts to return thousands of Syrian refugees. Iranian officials attending the conference also called on the international community to help provide Damascus with further infrastructure in efforts to bring Syrian refugees back. Our Damascus correspondent Mohammed Ali says several meetings are taking place on the sidelines of an undergoing international conference on the return of Syrian refugees. Here he is.
There are many meetings and tours that will happen outside the area of the event where the conference is happening, where I am now at Ebla Palace in Damascus countryside. And most of the meetings that are scheduled to happen today are between the Syrian and Russian sides, despite the fact that there are about 27 states participating in this conference. Of course, there are a couple of states that should have been attending yesterday, but they didn't show up, like the UAE and Egypt. This is according to the foreign ministry here in Syria. The United Nations is attending as an observer, of course. Later in the day, there will be meetings between Syrian and Russian officials in this place where I am at. Fields of transport, health, and various sectors, actually, to develop the cooperation relations, in particular between Syria and Russia.
Iran's ambassador to the IAEA has urged the UN nuclear watchdog to refrain from making hasty comments about the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. Kazim Gharib Abadi said Iran is involved in interactions with the IAEA despite technical differences with the agency. He made the remarks after the body claimed that Iran has not provided a technically credible response to the presence of uranium particles at what it called an undeclared nuclear site. The IAEA added that it continues to verify the non-diversion of nuclear material declared by Iran under its safeguards agreements. Omar Lezghi says the International Atomic Energy Agency's report of Iran's low-enriched uranium stockpile is what Tehran had announced to do so before.
The Iranian envoy to the IAEA has said that indeed the report does include this information that Iran's stockpile of low-enriched uranium has been increasing. There's not been any change in that, basically, since Iran's announcement that it is going to increase its stockpile beyond the limits set in the JCPOA, not just the amount, but also the level of purity. So it's enriching uranium up to 4.5% rather than the 3.67% that was the limit set in the JCPOA or the nuclear deal. And as our viewers may know, that is, of course, how Iran was responding to the fact that U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the JCPOA in May of 2018, and the Europeans were not able to give Iran the economic incentives that were enshrined in the deal. But Iran has also made it clear that these measures are all reversible, that if the United States does come back to the deal, and if the Europeans also give Iran the economic benefits that are part of that deal, then it can reverse these actions and it will go back to the limits set in the deal.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, meanwhile, has urged transparency in Saudi Arabia and Israel's nuclear programs. In a speech to the UN General Assembly, Majid Takht Ravanchi stressed that if Riyadh seeks to pursue a peaceful nuclear program, it must grant the International Atomic Energy Agency's inspectors access to its facilities. The Iranian diplomat also noted that Israel is not yet a party to the non-proliferation treaty and has so far rejected inspection of its nuclear activities. Dr. Avanchi said over the past year, 22% of IAEA inspections were carried out in Iran, and that even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped the agency's activities in the country. He also condemned the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and Washington's violation of UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Elsewhere, the United Nations has warned of a looming catastrophe in Yemen as the country is grappling with years of destructive Saudi war.
We're on a countdown right now to a catastrophe in Yemen. The people, they've been ravaged by years of conflict, feud, hunger, malnutrition. Now there's a toxic combination taking place of surging violence, as Martin was talking about, and Mark referenced a deepening of the economic and currency collapse that Mark just referred to, and COVID-19 is ratcheting up the misery to a whole new level.
The UN official further said the world must realize the unfolding humanitarian disaster in Yemen before it's too late. David Beasley added that Yemen will be plunged into a devastating famine affecting millions of people within a few short months. The UN has called for aid operations as the most efficient way to support famine prevention efforts. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people and displaced many. The UN describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And after a lull in arms sales to Saudi Arabia, the UK government has processed a backlog of hundreds of sales applications. Rights groups say the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which has caused the worst humanitarian crisis of our times, is more than enough evidence of Riyadh's human rights abuses. But the British government begs to differ. Priyanka Rahimi has more.
The death toll from the Saudi-led war on Yemen is in the hundreds of thousands. A quarter of all civilians killed in air raids are women and children. Roughly 20 million Yemenis are experiencing food insecurity, and at least half of those are at risk of famine. Saudi-led airstrikes hit schools, hospitals, and wedding parties indiscriminately. Britain sells billions of pounds worth of arms to Saudi Arabia, but sales were halted in June 2019 after a high court case brought by the Campaign Against Arms Trade ruled the sales were unlawful because ministers had failed to properly assess the risk of these weapons being used against civilians in Yemen. But the moratorium was lifted in July 2020 after International Trade Secretary Liz Truss announced a government review has concluded the potential for British-made weapons to be used to commit war crimes in the conflict was isolated, and that there was little evidence of a pattern of Saudi airstrikes targeting civilians. Rights groups say that simply is not true.
The sales being approved today could be used to fuel abuses for years to come. The humanitarian crisis in Yemen is only getting worse. But Liz Truss and her colleagues are more concerned with boosting arms company profits than they are with the rights and lives of people in Yemen.
But are Yemeni rights and lives Westminster's priority? In 2016, when challenged by opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn over arms sales to Saudi Arabia, then Prime Minister Theresa May said this. Actually, what matters is the strength of our relationship with Saudi Arabia. When it comes to counter-terrorism and dealing with terrorism, it is that relationship that has helped to keep people on the streets of Britain safe. Anti-arms trade campaigners say the decision to process over 500 applications for arms sales to Saudi Arabia is simply immoral and have filed a case to challenge it yet again. Bianca Rahimi, London.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. Today we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, riot gear, and canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
This is going to be my fighter right here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed. because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. And that, I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Richard was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Leek, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalised racism. And that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel, because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and colour pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the streets just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the street with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the top of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted, yes, as saying, the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy, in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same. I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that, actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. So the way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the camera,
they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add to
that? I think what it also leads to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on in this fight.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
racial
inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowd in support of the black community.
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies, this is two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one of my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff, and that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, you know. And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
So David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. He's quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually. to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks, and they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile as
portrayed in the film? Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that moratorium of silence that we've had for so long, and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long as it's filmed
now from the discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
It must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire, and by the Washington Post it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017. Those are the numbers you expect in a small war, somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. But then every investigation into every race, every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean, everywhere. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, it's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and marginalization, and it's that system that's carried on, and people are just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world, and it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we must put out. That's how dangerous this man is.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lou. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camille Chambiati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام في الإمام زين العابدين عليه السلام إنه كان يخرج في الليلة الظلماء فيحمل الجراب على ظهره حتى يأتي بابا بابا ويقرعه ثم يناول من كان يخرج إليه وكان يغطي وجهه إذا ناول فقيرا لئلا يعرفه.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, describing his father Imam Zain al-Abidin, stated, he used to go out in the dark night carrying a sack on his back and going from door to door, knocking on each and giving to whoever came out to answer it. He used to cover his face when giving to the poor in order that they may not recognize him.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, he has this dialogue with one of his companions in which he talks about the rights which Islam has legislated for one Muslim towards another Muslim brother. Now, it's very interesting, but we find that Imam Zain al-Abidin, the father of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he also has this beautiful treatise on the rights that a human being has. For example, he talks about the rights of a human being with Allah, the rights of one person with another, the rights of a person with himself, the rights of a person with creation. And so it seems that along these lines, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in this dialogue with one of his companions, again talks about the rights which Islam has legislated for one Muslim towards another Muslim. Imam al-Baqir says, love your Muslim brother. Love for him what you love for yourself. Hate for him what you hate for yourself. When you are in need of a certain thing, then ask him for that thing. And when he asks you for a certain thing, then give that thing to him. Very beautiful, very profound, and very deep rights which have been talked about by Imam al-Baqir in this dialogue with his companion. first and foremost, love your Muslim brother. Do we not find in the world that this is one of the main problems, is that we don't love one another, we don't respect one another, we don't take care of one another, whether we're Muslim or non-Muslim. And then Imam al-Baqir says, love for this person what you love for yourself, and hate for that person what you hate for yourself. It is like Imam al-Baqir is saying in this dialogue that you should treat them as if they are yourself. And finally, when you need something, ask your brother. And when he needs something, give that thing to him. Very beautiful words, which will create a better world, a more beautiful world, an everlasting world, a peaceful world, a just world, a loving world, if we follow these sayings, these commandments found in this dialogue between one of the companions of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and Imam al-Baqir himself. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Quran and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. Look at the issue of utensils from non-Muslims. You travel, go to a hotel, you know, there is a coffee maker and a cup there, china. Not paper cup, that's not a problem. You just use it and throw it. What do I do? Do I have to go and make it tahir first before I use it? Or there is a glass there for me to drink water? Well, it's not from Muslims. When it comes to utensils, we are not talking about meat products here. Not a leather made item. Nothing from animal product. You know, again, it's the same principle comes in. For example, there is one hadith that we have from the fifth imam, and I'm just selecting the hadith from the fifth imam, because on every issue and example that, you know, we have hadith from many, many imams. Muhammad bin Muslim, a very prominent sahabi of the imam, he asked about aniyati ahli dhimma, utensils of the non-Muslims who live under Islamic rule. Then Imam says, "La ta'kulu fiha idha kanu ya'kuluna fiha al-mayta wal-dama wal-lahm al-khinzir." If you know that that utensil has been used for a haram item, whether it's pork or a maita, non-zabiha, you know, meat, and things like that, don't eat it. But if you don't know about it, then you assume it to be pork because it is utensils, nothing to do with animal products or not even made from, you know, leather and things like that.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.